The last investigator I met with was Dr. John Leonard, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This is a 42-year-old male who I'd taken care of, really observed. His primary doctor was following him for the most part. Over the course of about 3 or 4 years, he presented with lymphadenopathy and lymphocytosis was observed, really a fairly typical presentation of CLL. Obviously, the fact that he was 42 is unusual, but he really was in good shape, wanted to delay therapy, was feeling well. And then really over the last few months, his lymphadenopathy got worse. His white count got up to the 200,000 range. And as the audience knows, I mean, that in and of itself is not horrible. But when you start to get anemia and thrombocytopenia, you need to intervene.
So his counts were starting to drop?
Right. His hemoglobin was right around 10 or 11. His platelets were getting down around 100,000 or so. And it became pretty clear with him that he needed therapy. So we had a lot of discussion about what to do. He is a very savvy guy. He'd done his research. He was familiar with regimens like FCR. He'd heard of ibrutinib. And, you know, we really ran the gamut in talking about what to go through with him.
Can you talk through some of the options that might be considered and, you know, sort of what you thought the best option theoretically would be for him?
Sure.
Now, let's just say outside a trial to start with.
Sure, sure. So the question in somebody like this, a young patient, he clearly needs therapy. You'd like to get a durable remission with him. You also have an eye toward long-term toxicity and the potential of cytopenias and secondary malignancies, et cetera. Really, I think the standard approaches include regimens like FCR and BR. I think we have data suggesting that they are fairly comparable in efficacy, perhaps FCR a little bit better in PFS and CR rate and MRD negativity, but on the other hand, a little more toxicity and fairly similar, at least at this point, overall survival. So I think that's one set of options, the FCR-BR discussion.
What was his IGVH status?
He had mutated disease and really had normal cytogenetics as well. So that was one set of options. Being 42 years old and savvy, he had been following the CLL literature, wasn't hugely excited about getting chemotherapy. We did talk about the fact that some people, particularly at MD Anderson, have some very long remitters with FCR, but he really was not excited about getting chemotherapy.
Before you go on, I am curious because, of course, there's been a lot of discussion about it, and people do bring up this issue of the possibility of long-term unmaintained remission. In your own hands, or, you know, what do you think should be expected? What did you say to him about the chance of that happening?
Yeah, I find that kind of hard to nail down because I think that you look at the curves and you look out 10 years in the curves and you see, I would say, somewhere in the range of about 20% or so of people in subgroups with FCR seem to be doing well in some of the MD Anderson data. The question I would say is really, what's the denominator there? The idea that a young person is going to go another 50 years and not relapse for CLL, I think is pretty unlikely. And I honestly am fairly skeptical of that. I think once you get out 10 years, you know, how hard are you looking for disease? Are you doing bone marrows? Are you doing MRD assessment? If you really looked at that person who got FCR who hasn't relapsed in 10 years, are you going to find something if you look really hard? And I'm not convinced that that is either necessary, but also to really prove the point that you're theoretically curing somebody.
Maybe at a more practical level, what would you estimate for a patient like this? The chance might be that 5 years later, they won't require any therapy, whether they're cured or not.
Yeah, well, I think the data from the German randomized trial with both BR and FCR is you're getting out in the ballpark of 4 to 5 years or so. And so that's what I would say for the average person as far as a progression-free survival. Now, not requiring therapy, as you know, just because they relapse. So I would say that those people who progress could obviously go a year or two or longer not needing treatment. So, you know, realistically, I told him that you'll probably get roughly 5 years out of it.
And I am curious, though, because you kind of, you know, it's interesting to kind of get this flavor from you because most people looked at that data from the German trial that was presented a year plus ago and came away thinking that, you know, FCR was substantially better. But you kind of seem like maybe not quite so convinced that it's that much different.
Well, you know, the PFS differences were within 6 months or so. So in the guy who's, you know, you're hoping he's going to live another 30 or 40 years with new therapies of CLL, does 6 months really make a difference? There is some element of MDS and other things with FCR in a young guy. There is more infection, not that he can't get it. So I think it's kind of a wash, honestly.
So I'm curious, when did you make the decision? Because things are happening so fast in CLL. I'm curious when you actually had this discussion with them.
This patient started therapy within the last 6 months or so. So we did have the German data.
Yeah. Right. But on the other hand, you didn't have the approval of ibrutinib for whatever that's worth. But in any event, certainly, theoretically, ibrutinib would be something you'd be thinking about in a situation like this. Of course, that's going to be committing to long-term therapy. Yeah. I'm sure that was one of the options you discussed with him. How did he react to that?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, was the committing to long-term therapy. And a guy who's 42, and for various reasons, he had an interesting perspective on expenses to drugs and was concerned not only about him taking the drug long-term, but paying for the drug long-term. And I think that he was certainly very familiar and is familiar with ibrutinib. His main concern, I think, was staying on a drug indefinitely and the expense that was associated with that. And so I think he was looking for other options that might allow him to have a long remission that weren't chemotherapy, but that also he wouldn't have to take for years and years and years.
He had private insurance?
Through his business, it was kind of self-insured. And so he was worried that, you know, one way or another, that his business was going to be involved in and responsible for what could add up to millions of dollars if he did well on ibrutinib for years. So that was in his mind. Now, if it was a definitive advantage otherwise, I think that wouldn't have been the deciding thing, but it was certainly one thing that entered his mind.
Any other non-protocol options you thought about other than FCR, BR, and ibrutinib?
No, I think those were, you know, he's clearly too young and you wouldn't give him chlorambucil. I wouldn't give him fludarabine alone. And this is not somebody that I would give anything else with, I think, chemotherapy-wise. These were really the things I was focused on.
One of the reasons I asked you about how long ago you was diagnosed was that it was interesting. The combination he ended up on was not too bad, particularly considering it was part of a trial.
Yeah.
What happened?
So he opted to go on a clinical trial that we have with obinutuzumab and venetoclax, and he's done very, very well with it. I mean, impressively well. And the concept of the trial is basically starting with a short course of obinutuzumab to debulk the disease, get his counts down, then get venetoclax. There's a fairly intensive tumor lysis monitoring as part of it, but it was a little more relaxed because his white count had come down. And then now he's basically continuing on outpatient venetoclax and obinutuzumab. And I think he's done very, very well. He's tolerated it well. Really, his lymphadenopathy is basically totally resolved on exam, and his counts are normal. So he's very happy.
Can you talk a little bit about what exactly venetoclax is and how it works?
So venetoclax is a BCL-2 inhibitor. It's kind of a second-generation BCL-2 inhibitor. And the concept is that BCL-2 plays a significant role in CLL cells and their ability to stay alive. And so it's an oral agent. Its main toxicity and the main challenge with it, at least so far, is the issue of tumor lysis that came up with earlier patients on the initial trials with CLL. But now I think has been very carefully worked out, and we've had several patients on this trial that have gone well. I think the issue is really following very carefully the recommended dosing schedule, and in many of the studies, the concept of debulking so that you minimize the tumor lysis risk has come up, and I think so far it's going smoothly. We'll see how it goes as more patients are treated.
And what exactly happened to the tumor? How long was he on the obinutuzumab alone, and what happened during that time?
So he was on the obinutuzumab alone for a couple of weeks, and then the venetoclax was added in. His counts came down from about 200,000 to about 20,000. He tolerated the infusions well. He did have some fevers and infusion-type reactions that we expect with obinutuzumab, but he did tolerate the infusions, particularly after he'd had a couple under his belt.
When you say his counts came down, that was on the obinutuzumab?
Right. His white count came down from about 200,000 to about 20,000 just with a couple doses of the obinutuzumab. So,
how many patients have you treated on this study?
On this study, our center is somewhere around 5 to 10 patients altogether.
And then when you brought in the venetoclax, what happened?
He's just continued to improve. I mean, he stays on the obinutuzumab also. So, you know, it's hard to know which because he's getting both. There's overlapping therapy right now, but he's continued to respond well. So I think both agents are certainly contributing.
And this protocol calls for treatment to be continued indefinitely unless toxicity or progression?
It's not an indefinite treatment. There is a time limit to it, but it's easier for him in many ways from the standpoint of hopefully being able to kind of back off on therapy altogether. But I think we're still learning on, you know, what's the optimal duration and keeping people on it.
Now, you mentioned the infusion reaction with obinutuzumab. There's been a lot of discussion about it. How exactly did it play out with him, and how does that compare to other experiences you've had with this drug?
Well, I think the data with obinutuzumab, you know, it's been used primarily in CLL. We know that with rituximab, there are more rituximab CLL infusion reactions than we see in other lymphomas. I would say that it's a little bit more than we tend to see in rituximab, which is what the data certainly supports. But we follow the recommended dosing schedule. There's a stepped-up dosing schedule where you divide with the first course of treatment and pre-medicated with steroids. And he, you know, it's been manageable. It hasn't been exceptionally worse. It's been in the range, more or less, of what we've seen before with rituximab.
This is certainly a great story. Maybe you can summarize a little bit about, in general, what we know about venetoclax and CLL, both as a single agent and in combination.
Well, most of the data have been in relapse patients as a single agent, and the response rates have been relatively high. Most people are responding. I think the summary is that the treatment regimen is influenced by the tumor lysis syndrome risk. I think that's getting worked out. Certainly in relapse patients, that's less of a concern because, you know, they have fewer options. Obviously, you need to watch for it. I think when we start looking at upfront regimens, if you have to admit patients to the hospital to get it, you know, some patients are going to be less excited about that in general. So we'll see. It's still early days. But I think most likely that what the future is going to hold, I think, is combinations. And we're starting to see them with different chemotherapy regimens with obinutuzumab and in other settings.
So venetoclax is fast-tracked by the FDA and 17P, and I think there's another fast-track designation. If the drug were to become available, or if it were available right now, how would you incorporate it into your practice?
Well, I think I would be probably using it in people later in the course of the disease right now as a single agent. And then I think once we start to see more data, which we will see before long of the combinations, then it's going to come down to, you know, what does it add to the combination versus the toxicity and the challenge of giving it. Ultimately, I think that we'll probably end up with these regimens that are some sort of chemotherapy debulking followed by venetoclax or some overlapping with the chemotherapy and venetoclax. And the question then will be, what does the venetoclax add? But there's no doubt that in some refractory patients, it does have value and can work in resistant disease.
What is the thinking in terms of the potential to combine venetoclax and ibrutinib? I mean, they are different mechanisms. Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, I think those are studies that are getting underway. I think it certainly makes sense on an empiric basis. The question is really going to be, how do you demonstrate benefit? Are we doing randomized trials of ibrutinib alone versus ibrutinib combinations? There have been some chemotherapy combinations with ibrutinib also that are underway. So I think these are good problems to have, but at the end of the day, we're going to need the randomized trials of these combinations versus a single agent. And then the question is, do you use them concurrently or do you use them in sequence one after the other?
It's interesting that this man seemed to respond to that initial run-in period, I guess, or debulking period with the obinutuzumab. Of course, obviously, it was compared to rituximab with chlorambucil, and, you know, you see the numbers. But in your own practice, and I've heard people talk about using obinutuzumab alone, do you have any sense for what the activity of this drug is, particularly compared to rituximab?
Yeah. You know, I have been a little bit of a skeptic about obinutuzumab, but I do have to say that in CLL, I think it clearly is a better drug than rituximab, and we have data to support that now. I'm a little less sure in the other types of lymphoma, but I do think in follicular and large cell, we'll have to see what the data show compared to rituximab. But certainly in CLL, I think we are seeing more single-agent activity. As you know, rituximab in CLL is in the 10 to 30% range in the standard dosing, and it's pretty clear to me that obinutuzumab as a single agent is better than that in CLL. So it may be that the mechanism of action is more relevant in CLL versus some of the other lymphoma subtypes.
And certainly we've known for a long time, as you said, that there's a difference between CLL in terms of the biology and lymphomas. You would think that, you know, kind of maintenance rituximab in CLL isn't used very much. People aren't very excited about it. What about the concept, or I don't even know if there's any data on obinutuzumab maintenance?
You know, I think some of the standard regimens use a little bit more extended dosing than the 4 doses of rituximab that we commonly use. So, you know, I think that's being looked at. I think the concept of maintenance makes sense in the more effective the drug is, right? If the drug doesn't work so great, giving more of something that didn't work great doesn't work much. So in CLL, rituximab by itself doesn't work great. Giving more of it isn't going to work great. But if obinutuzumab or something else is a better drug, giving more of a drug that can work probably will make more of a difference. So I think that makes sense to pursue. We'll see what the data show.
So I want to see how you put all this together in a second, but just to get all the elements out on the table, the other thing I want to ask you about in terms of CLL is adalimumab. And particularly, there was a big announcement that a bunch of trials have been closed. Can you talk about what was reported at ASH related to CLL with adalimumab, both upfront and in relapse disease, and this recent FDA or whatever trial closing thing?
Yeah, so there have been some data reported. Certainly, the original data with idelalisib have been with single-agent idelalisib. Then there have been studies combining it with rituximab and comparing idelalisib rituximab to rituximab or idelalisib to rituximab. So there are a number of different studies that are out there. I think it's clearly a very good drug for CLL. And certainly, if patients have some contraindications to ibrutinib, would be one place that we do see it. We've seen some randomized data combining it with bendamustine rituximab showing benefit there. The recent data, to my knowledge, have suggested that there are some toxicities that have emerged in some of the later studies, particularly around infections, respiratory infections, things like pneumocystis as an example. And so I think that the take-home message, on the other hand, is that we've got some positive studies where people are doing well with the drug and benefiting with the drug. One of the themes about the studies that have had the recent issues are that they are in less heavily pretreated patients. And so one interpretation of this, and I'm sure people are working very hard to sort through all of this, but one interpretation of this is that in the more heavily pretreated patient, there's clearly a risk benefit to using the drug, meaning the patients are so sick that they really need the drug and the infections are a relatively minor thing because the risk of the disease and the deaths from the disease are high, so the toxicity is relatively less. On the flip side, early in the course of the disease, the patients are better prognosis, they're not dying from the disease, so whatever adverse events you see take on greater importance. So I think the take home out of this is that idelalisib is probably going to get used more in more resistant patients and less in the early disease setting because the risk benefit favors using the drug in the patients that have worse disease.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about mantle cell lymphoma. Maybe we can get into that by talking about your 78-year-old lady.
So this is a 78-year-old patient with mantle cell lymphoma who, interestingly, was originally thought by an outside institution to have CLL in her presentation being lymphocytosis and splenomegaly, as well as a little bit of adenopathy. Over time, it became more obvious that this was mantle cell, and we evaluated her and did the proper genetic testing, but it's a reminder that sometimes patients can be thought to have CLL, but really need to be confirmed that it's not mantle cell for that leukemic type of presentation.
Could I just ask, is this really just a phenotypic similarity in how it presents, or biologically, is mantle cell similar to CLL?
Well, it could be either way. There are occasional cases of cyclin D1 negative mantle cell lymphoma. There are CD23 expression can be variable sometimes. And so if you're only doing flow with outside of genetics, sometimes people can be fooled a little bit by that. There is also a subset of mantle cell patients that clearly have mantle cell lymphoma. They have the 1114 translocation, but they have a CLL type presentation. I saw a patient yesterday in clinic, a young patient who presented on a physical exam with a lymphocytosis and mild splenomegaly. You know, you would have thought 9 times out of 10 in your practice, you get that referral at CLL. And in his case, it was mantle cell lymphoma. So it can happen that way.
Just out of curiosity, with that patient you saw yesterday, did you decide to observe or treat?
That patient we decided to observe, yeah.
And as long as we're getting into that, because you certainly had a leadership role in sort of identifying this issue, anything new that we've learned about this right now? What's your take in terms of the frequency that you see this sort of indolent disease that can be observed, and any sense about how that's getting managed in the community setting?
Well, so the concept of indolent mantle cell lymphoma is one that is certainly intriguing, and it makes it harder to explain things to patients why you can have an indolent, the same diagnosis, and in some people it putters along for years, and in others it's explosive blastoid sort of picture. But really, I think my take-home message is that we're not yet at the point that we can use a molecular test or the pathology to say this is indolent or not. You really have to use your clinical judgment. There is some evidence that low Ki-67 rates and low proliferation by that marker is more likely to be indolent. But mostly, it's just following the patient and getting your clinical sense as you would with an indolent lymphoma.
In your own hands, typically, how often are you able to observe patients, and what's the longest you've been able to observe people?
Well, I think I have to say that this patient came from some distance away. I think because we've been very interested in this area and reported on it, there are a fair number of patients that come find us who think they have indolent mantle cell lymphoma, or someone says. So I have to acknowledge that we may have a selection bias, but it's probably somewhere in the range of 20 to 30% of people, I think, can wait a period of time. Now, sometimes it's just 3 or 4 months, but I'm probably with some people out 7 or 8 years watching them at this point, and I've heard of a few that are longer.
So this lady, getting back to your 78-year-old patient who initially got treated with RCVP and then BR and now several years out, how was she presenting clinically at that point?
So she'd gotten RCVP, she'd gotten BR, she had really presented with lymphadenopathy at various points in time. At this relapse, her main presentation was that she had axillary adenopathy. She also very interestingly had extranodal disease with one of her areas kind of in her subclavicular area, kind of her chest wall, some fullness. And then she also had a very painful area in her pretibial area, right, in her leg, which was swollen. You'd almost look at it and say, oh, this is just leg edema. But it was so painful, we actually imaged it and biopsied it, and it showed mantle cell lymphoma, kind of the subcutaneous area in her lower leg.
Interesting. Before you go on, can you comment on some of the other extranodal sites you've seen involvement with, particularly GI, also CNS?
So extranodal disease is common in mantle cell. I think most commonly in certain series, you know, at least 90%, if not more, of patients with mantle cell will have GI involvement if you look for it, particularly in the colon. And it's not a rare thing. I have probably 10 patients right now I'm following who just had a screening colonoscopy and, you know, get a polyp. They think it's a benign polyp and it's mantle cell lymphoma, and that's the only site of disease. Those tend to be people with relatively indolent disease if it's colon only. So that's relatively common in the scheme of things. I've seen it. I'm treating a patient now with lacrimal gland mantle cell lymphoma. Wow. And I have several patients with that. Sometimes in the lung, like a malt lymphoma of the lung, we've sometimes seen it. Brain involvement with mantle cell lymphoma, if you look at the older literature, you would think it's very common. I would say that I've rarely seen it except in the cases where it's really someone with very resistant disease, blastoid disease, and kind of been through lots of therapies and resistant to other treatment. But, you know, we've seen some various things. We have a patient now that we've been treating, a young patient with blastoid variant who's got kidney involvement and uptake in his kidneys and adrenals, which is very unusual. But, you know, really colon is the big area that we see most commonly.
Now, this lady at that point in time that you were ready to treat her, was she having symptoms from the disease?
She was having symptoms. She was a little bit thrombocytopenic, a little bit of splenomegaly, but really her leg was hurting her the most. The subcutaneous nodule in her leg was causing swelling and pain, and she really, even to touch it, was quite annoying to her. It almost looked like she had a cellulitis there or something, but it was lymphoma.
Any comorbidities, or is she in good condition otherwise?
She's somebody who has had hepatitis in the past, hep B in the past, but had been treated and had a negative viral load. And beyond that, other than being in her 70s, is active and goes shopping and out to dinner and socializes, et cetera, takes care of herself.
She also ended up on a trial that I think is really interesting. But before we get into that, can you talk about sort of how you would think through in a patient like this, the various, actually quite a few options outside a trial setting?
Well, I think this is a patient, you know, she'd had RCVP, she had bendamustine rituximab. When you think about approved agents for relapsed mantle cell, you think about bortezomib, which has about a 30% response rate, obviously could be weekly or biweekly subcutaneously now. I would say that we've used that the most in combination and we have data in combination. I think it's got about a 30% response rate as a single agent.
What kind of combination are you talking about?
The BVR regimen is being used on protocol. I think when you substitute in the vincristine for R-CHOP also, as in the randomized trial, that would be another setting where we've seen some good results there.
But you're talking about up front.
Up front, yes. But I've on occasion used that in relapse patients as well. So for instance, a patient treated with BR up front, I might use that as a second line regimen if they needed chemotherapy and were ill.
Of course, another approved agent is lenalidomide, either alone or with rituximab. How does that fit into your choices?
So yeah, I was going to say that's the other choice. And I would probably also consider using lenalidomide rituximab in this patient. I think that's a very reasonable choice for her. It's probably easier for her and for others from the standpoint of versus taking bortezomib, but certainly that would be a reasonable choice as well. And then now we have ibrutinib.
So generally speaking, in a patient like this outside a trial setting, what do you think you might have been thinking about?
This is somebody I probably would have used single agent ibrutinib, I think would have been my first choice because of the response rates. And after that, I probably would have been using lenalidomide and then bortezomib. That would be kind of my ranking for most patients outside of trials.
Where are we today right now with the lenalidomide rituximab R-squared regimen? You've published on that both in terms of ongoing trials looking at this as well as data that we already have.
Lenalidomide rituximab, when we're talking about mantle cell, lenalidomide has an approval with about a 30% response rate, give or take, in the relapse setting as a single agent. I think many people are using it in combination with rituximab. I think it's a very active approach. The question is, what about using it earlier in the course of the disease? As you alluded to, we reported some data with lenalidomide rituximab in a fairly balanced, albeit small study in patients with upfront mantle cell. We're now out in that group of patients over 3 years median. Most of them are still in remission, so I think it's a very effective regimen. We're now in that study out 5 years with some patients still in remission on therapy. So, you know, how long it'll work remains to be seen, but it certainly is one approach. The other approach is the ECOG study, which is a four-arm study where everyone's getting treated with bendamustine rituximab, and then some people have bortezomib added into the BR, and then in the maintenance, everyone gets maintenance either rituximab alone or R-squared. So I think that if you look at BR followed by R, that's a very good regimen for mantle cell, and I would say that probably the PFS of that is going to be somewhere out between 4 and 5 years. And so if you add lenalidomide to the maintenance and add bortezomib, you may be really having quite durable remissions with that sort of approach. So we'll see what the data show. But I think this kind of combination cocktail, which to some degree is what's happening in myeloma as well, where you go from one thing to another or one maintenance after one induction, is probably where we're heading in mantle cell.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about myeloma, and I always think about it when we talk about mantle cell, and that trial in particular because of the len bortezomib maintenance that's being studied, because they kind of came in the back end starting out with len, and now they're starting to add in bortezomib. The other thing that you hear a lot about, obviously, in myeloma that I'm curious whether it's been discussed in lymphoma, particularly in the maintenance setting, is the idea of oral proteasome inhibitors. Now, in the last few months, we actually have one approved, exazimib. People are excited about combining exazimib and len as maintenance in myeloma. What about exazimib or oral proteasome inhibitors in mantle cell and in lymphomas?
You know, we've seen some small studies of the oral proteasome inhibitors in lymphoma. I would say that those studies have been limited in size and they've been non-randomized. Clearly, they're active. I've not really so far seen them taken forward as single agents that much beyond, you know, what we've seen with bortezomib. So I've not seen a big phase two study in mantle cell, for instance, or in follicular lymphoma. We are seeing a few combinations, but for whatever reason, I think that they, not because they don't work, I just don't know if the path forward for them has been quite so obvious or dramatic as some of the other things out there in these diseases.
You know, I've heard the term crowded space referred to in terms of this, with so many new drugs becoming available that people want to study. A lot of people in this situation, and you talk about as your first-line therapy, is ibrutinib. Before we talk about the trial she went on, I'm also curious about the issue of after ibrutinib. I saw a paper that you did looking at people who'd gotten ibrutinib with mantle cell showing a really kind of dismal prognosis after they have progressive disease. What do you think is going on there?
Well, I think the jury is still out. You know, we looked at patients who were largely treated on some of the initial trials. So the caveat is that they had been through lots of prior treatment. So what you allude to is the fact that the outcomes, meaning overall survival of people that were treated on ibrutinib on a trial, seems to be low once they progress. And so one interpretation is that these are just beaten up patients. They've been through lots of different treatments. Their disease is resistant. They get ibrutinib, they benefit, and then they have limited other options. The other is that somehow the ibrutinib therapy is changing the nature of the disease, selecting out a clone, selecting out mutations, or changing the biology. I think that that's still a possibility. And I've had patients ask me about using ibrutinib up front. That's something that in the back of my mind, I say, well, gee, am I going to be changing their disease so that it'll be more aggressive? I think we need to do that as part of trials. I don't think I would do that now, kind of off protocol, give up front ibrutinib. But I think it's something we have to watch for very carefully. I was relieved a little bit. There was a European study presented at ASH comparing temsirolimus, which is approved in Europe, to ibrutinib, and clearly showing a benefit to ibrutinib, not surprisingly. But the important and interesting thing was that that was a group of patients that had had one prior regimen, and they seemed to do better, those that progressed on ibrutinib. There was some data presented in the oral presentation. When they looked at those patients, they didn't have quite such the dismal prognosis as we've seen in other studies. So that was a group of patients less heavily pretreated, suggesting that it may be the patients rather than the use of the drug that resulted in the outcome that we saw.
I was also curious whether what we know about post-ibrutinib with CLL, has that been looked at? Is that also have a, I mean, not that many people relapse with CLL, so I'm not sure how much we know about it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it may be some of the same story in that the initial studies, most of the progressors are in people that have had prior treatment. So if you've had BR or FCR, and then you get ibrutinib, and then you progress, you know, you've got disease that's been through many of the treatments. Now, the question will be, how will those people do with obinutuzumab? How will those people do with venetoclax? How would they do with some of the other BTK inhibitors that are coming along as well? So all that, I think, is kind of a moving target right now.
This lady ended up on a really interesting trial. Maybe you can talk about that.
So this is a study. We and others participated in the drug palbociclib, which your audience is probably familiar with breast cancer. It's a cell cycle inhibitor. And obviously, mantle cell lymphoma, cell cycle is important with cyclin D1 expression. And so having a drug that can target CDK4 and CDK6 makes a lot of sense. There are a few other cell cycle inhibitors out there, but this is the one that's approved for breast cancer. We did a study with the Dana-Farber group a couple of years ago showing that palbociclib had single agent activity in relapsed mantle cell lymphoma, and also that it hit the target, that we could demonstrate that Ki-67 expression and other markers of cell cycle actually went down when you gave the drug. So it was a nice translational study. We have a lot of preclinical data from Selena Chin Kang in our group at Cornell, and Peter Martin has led this study where, you know, as you know, ibrutinib has about a 70% response rate in relapsed patients, roughly a year PFS, give or take. And so the idea is that by adding palbociclib, can we improve the response rate, improve the durability? There's a lot of preclinical data. We've done tumor biopsies before and after treatment and shown that we've changed some of the cell cycle proteins appropriately. And so far in the study, it's an ongoing study, but we do seem to be seeing more CRs than you'd expect with ibrutinib alone, although obviously one would need a randomized trial to do that. But this is nice because it's an oral agent. There's a little more cytopenias when you add this drug to the ibrutinib. That's one of the side effects of palbociclib that people are no doubt familiar with. But it's a pretty manageable oral regimen, so we'll see where it goes.
Of course, you know, in breast cancer, they're combining with hormone therapy, which usually doesn't cause any problems. But I've heard the breast cancer people really comment on the neutropenia, even though it seems like they don't see many neutropenic infections. But, you know, they're constantly getting counts. There's a lot of dose adjustments. Is that what you're seeing here with mantle cell?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we are using in this trial lower doses of palbociclib than you would give in mantle cell. So you can see the targets hit with lower doses. So, but yes, that's it. And, you know, you would expect that hematopoietic progenitor cells are cycling and that a cell cycle inhibitor is going to give you some cytopenias. So it's not a huge surprise.
So what happened with this lady?
So she's doing well. She has a little fatigue with this treatment, but she's doing well. She's in what I would say is a very good PR, close to a CR. Her leg symptoms are gone. Her mass on her leg has disappeared. And basically, she has some very small lymph nodes that are residual there. She's been on this altogether, I would say, about 6 months or so, and tolerating it well, and has had a very good response. I think the question is this better than ibrutinib alone? And time will tell, but she's certainly off to a good start with it.
How did she do with her counts?
She's actually been very good with her counts. So she's got a little bit of fatigue, a little bit of diarrhea, which, as you know, are side effects of these drugs, or can be. But her counts have not been an issue at all.
So you mentioned other CDK4 inhibitors, and I know it seems like Dana-Farber group is particularly interested in it. They've studied one called abemaciclib, and it seems like even, you know, maybe more active, even palbo, you see single agent responses. Any other these inhibitors that are being studied right now in mantle cell?
There's one that we're studying called copanlisib. It's a compound that basically is an alpha-delta inhibitor. And one of the things in mantle cell is that the delta inhibitor, which is idelalisib, alpha expression goes up. And so that's a mechanism of resistance to idelalisib, is that the PI3 kinase alpha goes up. And so this is a dual alpha-delta inhibitor. And in fact, we're testing it in ibrutinib-resistant patients because we're trying to see, and we have some data, that it could be useful. So that's an ongoing study. And that drug's also being looked at in follicular lymphoma as well.
So you mentioned the issue of BR followed by R, and really kind of leading into the question of R maintenance in mantle cell. We saw some data at ASH 2014 looking at patients who had transplant. Prior to that, we saw patients' data of older patients. Right now, where do we stand in terms of data on this question, and what are you doing in your own practice?
Well, I think the best data for the role of maintenance rituximab in mantle cell lymphoma is a randomized study by the European group suggesting that after R-CHOP, if you respond to R-CHOP with mantle cell, that R-maintenance has an overall survival benefit. So the question is, not many people are using R-CHOP right now for mantle cell. If you're using an anthracycline, you may be using the bortezomib-containing R-CHOP version, or people are using BR. And so the question is, do you extrapolate from those studies and use R-maintenance after those regimens? And I have pretty much done that. If I use BR upfront, I will use R-maintenance, extrapolating from the R-CHOP data. So that's a scenario pretty much after upfront therapy where I'm using R maintenance in mantle cell. And, you know, in the relapse setting, I think it's a little less clear. Certainly, if you're keeping somebody on lenalidomide longer term, it would make sense that if R-square is better as kind of an induction regimen in some scenarios. And certainly, our trial has continued, the upfront trial has continued patients on lenalidomide and rituximab maintenance.
In the upfront setting, a lot of people talk about using 2 years of therapy, although the trial, I think, used indefinite treatment. What are you doing in terms of duration?
I would say that you're right. It was indefinite in the trial. I see how the patient's doing. I mean, if they're in a good CR and they want to stop doing it, I think it's okay. But I think that, you know, in most people, if they're tolerating it well and not having infections, I would keep them on it indefinitely as they did in the trial.
So I want to ask you about another paper that was presented at ASH, an intergroup study. I always thought this was a really interesting study to start with, which was pre-transplant use of R-bendamustine versus R-hypercVAD. It actually ended up getting closed, but they did present some data at ASH. Can you kind of talk about sort of the background of the trial, what happened with the trial, and then the data that they reported?
So the idea of this was to really compare R-bendamustine versus R-hypercVAD followed by autotransplant as initial therapy for mantle cell patients, and particularly younger patients. And one of the endpoints of the study was mobilization of stem cells. And so I think the bias of everybody going in was that, you know, R-bendamustine's an older person's regimen, it's not going to be that effective. And R-hypercVAD's a younger person regimen, and all these groups had used it pre-transplant and had good results and shown great curves, and that was clearly going to be the winner. I think we were all surprised when there were significant rates of mobilization failure with R-hypercVAD, suggesting that really in the real world that mobilization was a problem, and therefore a significant number of patients couldn't go on to get their transplant appropriately. And that we know is an issue with hypercVAD, is that it is profoundly myelosuppressive. There are people who have cytopenias and even MDS sometimes after it. But to have that documented as being such a common occurrence, I think, was a little bit surprising to everyone. So the other thing that came out of that, which informs our next set of trials, is that BR also gave high rates of minimal residual disease negativity. And so we're learning that MRD negativity correlates with better outcomes. And so I think our next generation of trials in the cooperative groups is really going to be focused on how can we get the most patients to MRD negativity? And then for those, once we get people in remission, if they're MRD negative, can we get rid of the transplant? If they're MRD positive, can we make the transplant better to try to convert them into longer-term remitters? So I think MRD is going to be an important endpoint in our future mantle cell lymphoma studies.
I think it kind of looked like the incidence of MRD and the responses in general were similar
right.
with BR to R-hyper-CVAD.
Right.
Why do you think that was, and how much R-hyper-CVAD actually ended up getting delivered as opposed to being held?
Yeah, I would say that there were a fair number of patients that didn't complete the regimen, but you're right. The fact that I would turn that into the idea that BR gives you such high rates of MRD negativity, why would you want hyper-CVAD if you could get the outpatient regimen? But I think our next generation of studies is going to be really focused on comparing, just like these two were compared, comparing a couple of different regimens with novel agents to see what gives you the best MRD negative rates, and then can you get away with leaving out the transplant.
I always thought this was kind of an interesting trial to get an informed consent to because, you know, it's kind of different in terms of what you might expect in terms of toxicity. When the trial was designed, was there any thought about doing R-Benda followed by transplant versus just R-hyper-CVAD without transplant?
You know, I think there was thought, and I think in developing these trials, you find, as you know, with treating mantle cell, when you've polled experts and you get your panel of responses, trying to get 10 people or even 3 people to agree on a regimen is tough. But yeah, I think a lot of people had thought that you don't need to do the transplant if you do hyper-CVAD. So I honestly think one of the results of this study is that we're moving away. I think people are starting to look at the bendarituximab plus ARA-C combinations, and I think that may be something that we in the U.S. explore further going forward, as have the Europeans.
This concludes our program, and we should note that subsequent to these interviews, on April 11th, the FDA granted approval to venetoclax for the treatment of patients with CLL and 17p deletion who've been treated with at least one prior therapy. Then on May 17th, the FDA granted accelerated approval to nivolumab for the treatment of patients with classical Hodgkin lymphoma that has relapsed or progressed after autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and post-transplantation brentuximab vedotin. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Hematologic Oncology Update.